Okay, I'm back. Next year, you know, my friend David St. John is, and I are going to try to put together a rock and roll band because we're, you know, it's really hard to follow music because music's so interesting. Well, here I go. We'll see what happens. And it's so good, too. Love it. I'm gonna read a long love poem first. In fact, I'm going to read almost all love poems. Actually, this is a long poem. It has two. We're all interested about in where we came from, I'm sure. And I simply have no idea. I know my mother was Irish and Catholic, and her family came from Waterford. She's a Mayo, and my father's side of the family is involved in endless deceptions and stories about, you know, where they were from, at least before the gold rush. So, but some of the letters are in French, and the poem involves that slightly. They were in Wisconsin. And anyway, this poem is mostly in blank verse, then moves into free verse at the end of it. It has two epigraphs, one from Ovid, book 10 of the Metamorphoses, spoken by Orpheus. I wanted to be able to bear this. I've tried to. And the other is, I wasn't born so much as I fell out, the clash. Anyway, here goes. Kind of a longish poem. I meant it to be really erotic as a poem, and I actually feel that it wound up simply being obscene. I apologize for that at the beginning, and also as a defense against possible subsequent criticism. Yeah. A letter. It's better to have a light jacket on days like this than a good memory. I would like not to remember for a while. I would like to stroll beside the river, the way the river strolls, with its quick insouciance, its impatience, when the shoreline of thick trees, factories, and lit houses narrows suddenly before a low spillway and a bridge with traffic passing or stalled above the water, which, turning white, does so only out of necessity and not for anyone's amusement. It is maybe 100 feet deep in the middle. Last week, two teenagers from Chicago, because they were in love, held hands and jumped, and were pulled onto a barge by men in gray rain slicks who risk getting maimed daily and who, as I learned later, sometimes are, and for wages that are water. The newspaper account said the five men asked the kids no questions, gave them coffee, and talked only of baseball. On days like this, students lie out on the riverbank getting tan. They wear next to nothing, just as in the 19th century, couples and whole families posed here, fully dressed and with hats on for the tinted photograph. In Black River Falls in 1870, their mill burned, and my ancestors held their breath anyway for an Easter portrait. They look hot, uncomfortable, and most of the men are dressed in black suits, too small for them. If you want to know, I'm thinking of the widow with the wide eyes, Nona LaRoche, who's dead now, and who, for days after that, could still smell smoke on her clothes. Because she was French, and without money then, because she had never voted, because all she had ever wanted was to live outside America, outside the stiff clothes framed by the photograph and the river and a pious smoke rising from each chimney. She had packed up everything left uncharred. In California, in a few years, she had taught the men to break horses so gently, they soon sold the fastest horses south of Sacramento. Their voices each morning soft, transparent as silk over the corrals and the black shade cast by the oak trees. And then, years later, 10 Malaga vine cuttings and more on the way, four mules enough water, the smell of smoke on their clothes again for weeks as they cleared the land and burned the silver limbs of cottonwoods. The bonnets the women wore to mass were a dark lace, a mystery even to them, and a grim Latin over their skulls. All made from the same lace, used for camisoles, which their men would undress later at night when there was plenty of water, and when the first wine made from plenty of laughter, and when the first wine made from those grapes was so bad it was hilarious. Did they love each other? Some great uncle, if the dead could shrug, and they can't, would say they love fast horses. Sometimes I almost believe her soul looks out of the photograph, almost clears the sill of the eyes and comes near, though it does not ever move. It holds me while I look at it. But even today I can't conceive of a soul without seeing a woman's body, specifically yours, undoing the straps of an evening dress in a convertible, and then lying back, your breasts holding that hint of dusk mixed with mint and the emptiness of dusk. Someone put it crudely, to fuck is to know. If that's true, there's a corollary. The soul is a canary sent into the mines. The convertible is white and parked beneath the black trees shading the river mile after mile. Your dress is off by now, and when you come, both above and below me, when you vanish into that one cry which means your body is no longer quite your own, and when your face looks like a face stricken from this world, a saint's face, your eyes closing on some final city made entirely of light, and only to be unmade by light again, at that moment I'm still watching you. Half out of reverence and half because the scene is distant like a landscape and has nothing to do with me. Beneath the quiet of those trees and that sky, I imagine I'm simply a miner in a cave. I imagine the soul is something lighter than a girl's ribbon I witnessed one afternoon as it fell, blue, tossed, withered somehow, and singular at a friend's wedding. And then into the river and swirled away. Do I chip away with my hammer? Do I sometimes sing or recite? Even though I have to know in such a darkness all the words by heart, I sing. And when I come, my eyes are closed fast. I smile under the earth. They love fast horses. Maybe the soul is only a still place in the body. The eye, and not the eye. Something both like an altar and like a sill opening onto a distant landscape. Often I think of the cliffs at Puye in New Mexico, how the Indians deserted them inexplicably and long before any white man knew where they were. They rise in their failure miles above the plain. They say if you go into a cave there, you can hear the soul, and that it sounds like someone singing and like someone scraping away at stone, though no one is there. After so many years, you and I should go there and sit and listen for a whole day and say nothing to each other. Or else, following local wisdom, we should put sharp stones in our shoes and walk uphill for 3 miles. And when our feet are bleeding with that kind of pain that isn't even pain anymore, we should go into a cave at the top of the cliffs and then undress each other and stand there, not touching. And if we want to, cry, for that is what the stones were for. Or else not cry. And finally, when we hear it, if we hear it at all, wait until it ceases. And then dress and descend in opposite directions and never again look back at each other as we did so often in bus depots, airports, bars, the porches of small apartments on late spring nights. Because if we never look back, we might acquire The true indifference of the soul as it travels as if on foot over rocks, roots, stream beds, through the smoke of distant cities, until it feels as if it is floating, a still place in the body that does not move, though we do. Even though probably that would not happen to us, we would probably feel childish and distant. We might even laugh. Today I talked to those men in the boat who save the two teenagers who unload off the pier there in Rock Island, Illinois, and who live on those barges. Already two of the youngest of them have one or two fingers missing. I finally overcame my shyness enough to ask them and understood at once when they told me not only about cable snapping, but about unloading at night, how you can hear almost nothing as the barge draws closer and closer to the dock, and how often the one light required by state law is burned out there, and how out of tiredness you might curl your hands unconsciously and out of habit over the bulkheads of the boat, just as the older men had cautioned you not to. And then you can almost hear over the slipping of water the soft, hollow thunk of wood on wood. That is, you might hear it if it weren't for the pain at that moment, how it erases almost everything else in your life and all sounds, until you know you will have this one life, this river, as long as you live, if only because no one else will hire you now. I talked to them a long time. At a certain hour of night, you can hear the precise fall of every syllable. You can hear the slipping of water. And you think you know why the lights on the opposite shore are silent, have always been silent, and why the Peabody coal mines in this part of the state are all boarded up by now. And no one, his pick or hammer fallen to one side like a world, is left down there. No one. Unless he wears an eternal smile on his face, which is a betrayal of all other smiles. I don't want to believe he is real, if only because teenagers swim nude in the quarries above those mines. And yet, now that I mention him, I think it is only right that he is there somehow, and that the mines are closed. I would like to believe that his grin might say how much the body misses its only abiding guest, or that the eye holes in every skull are merely cliff dwellings abandoned for higher and more lasting residences, or that it matters, being half French and a descendant of certain hard-headed horse trailers, drunks, gamblers, and women with lace camisoles who would as soon cut your throat as look at you, and who, out of some obscure gentleness, decided only to stare out finally from a photograph, as if in a kind of defiance or bewilderment. I wish I knew. Though at a certain hour of night the river here is so black, no one with any intelligence would try to tell you what it means. In my light jacket, I stroll beside the water. I am just going for a little walk. Goodbye for a while, and goodbye to my pet names for you. Wren, Fire, Threshold, names which only obscured you. And goodbye to songs the miner sings in the dead chill of winter as he reaches up, headlamp on his helmet, to chip away at a vein of coal. And that sound now is so far away. God rest you, merry gentlemen, that I can hear almost but not quite, only as chipping away at stone, as even that becomes a silence in the way of something much more silent. Let nothing you dismay. This next poem is about rock and roll. Mostly. As Keith Richards, Mick Jagger once said, rock and roll is about sex and risk. So is life. It's also about a lot of other things. After the Blue Note closes, the Blue Note is a bar, a kind of rock and roll bar in Columbia, Missouri. An old friend of mine rents the basement of my house for me and works at the Blue Note and at Streetside Records, and that's how I know so much more than I knew before coming back to Columbia. Poem about separation, too, from my wife, my son, basically. After the Blue Note closes. Tonight, holding a stranger in my arms, suddenly a downpour, a late summer storm, I thought of you, alone or not alone in that distant city. And at that hour when the punk musicians bar and the carpeted bars with their well-coiffed, careful clientele are closing. Alliteration's difficult, you can just say. Are closing. Those strangers pairing off at last, and each desiring what little mercy the other can afford. That wasted breath of neon light, a frail tattoo of a come on in pools of rain. That street. That rain. No, our street. Our rain. Holding her, not you. I watched it finally empty. Watched until the streaked reddening light of dawn came back and touched the quiet brick of empty dance halls, touched behind blackened tavern windows, a girl's clap cast off blouse, touched even the pocked faces of musicians on the posters there. Sick girl, the mistakes. Almost as if dawn light could hold all things, each piece of shattered glass, as if to somehow bless them or make them whole again. It can't or won't. And it is late for blessings. All night I've held a woman who tomorrow I will not want to see again.